So hi everybody. I won't make any personal introduction. I mean, you look at the links and you Google me or whatever, and you will find out. Maybe what is most relevant to this talk is the last link. A few preliminary remarks. First, when I speak of a non-market sphere of information exchanges, this is meant to be something a bit bigger, wider than the commons-based peer production of information. It's in the line of Yohai Benkler, describing, for example, things like all the open pages on the web as part of this non-market sphere, because you can cut and copy and cut and paste them, and you can, even if they are not given explicitly a common statute. But my core interest is, of course, for this commons-based peer production of information. Second remark is, why in the world would someone want to create synergy with the economy when so much sucks in the economy? There are two answers to that. The first one is, of course, it's not the same economy. It's synergy with an economy in transition, where the restructured economy could become something different. The second thing is, because we are in transition, it's maybe not a very cautious approach to take a purely confrontational approach to the relationship with the economy. It's maybe much more sensible to try to find how we can develop synergy, at least with large segments of it. Finally, there are notes in my presentation. That is, what I would be saying if I was a decent orator is in the notes, so you will access that on the site. First, I'm going to play you a number of centuries of history at the rate of 1 minute per century. So let's start by something like the 15th century, the beginning of a story that Fernand Braudel tells in Material Civilization, Economy and Capitalism, that describes the birth of the modern flavor of capitalism. And let's say, at least the representation he proposes is, there is a huge sphere of daily activities that is clearly done outside markets. It's a subsistence economy, self-production, little bits of barter. Then there is economy in the sense of markets. It's cornered in some specific parts of town, on the suburbs of towns. You know, this is not something that happens everywhere. It's very regulated where it can happen. It uses currency, but it uses it in a very localized way, and very quite similar to some local exchange system today. And finally, you have autonomous finance already existing, people who do lettres de change and from Genoa or Venezia. But this is a small thing, no time for a discussion about measuring the size of such things, but it's a small thing. Now let's go to the industrial era, let's say the second half of the 19th century and the 20th century until 1970. And we have non-market, of course. It's everywhere. It's still very important in time budgets, but it's considered as a sort of leftover. You know, in national accounts, they say, there is a small note footnote on the presentation, and it says the domestic production and other non-mediated activities have not been accounted for. And then you have a market, and the market has its logic of itself, but it is already dominated in its orientation by investment and capitalism in the financial sense. And of course, this financial part can expand and subsequently shrink. And this is what happened in that era, and it's probably something which is wrong to project on the present crisis, but because this is the representation we built in our history of the 1930s, we still project it. Now let's go to something like now. It's a long now, over tens of years. We have the old non-market, it's still there, and actually it has a new youth. Like, I think if you look at domestic vegetable gardens, you would see that they went down a lot and up some bit. Then you have a market, and I have given it not a bubble form, but a kind of all bizarre shape, because it's undergoing very strange trends. It is, at the same time, it is seen as an expanding beast, an imperialist beast, like Rifkin described, you know, the age of access, its new way, new culture of hyper-capitalism, where every moment of life is a paid-for experience. It so seemed like there would be marketization going to grab every piece of our human activities. But at the same time, there is a demarketization, or at least I claim so, and so did, for example, André Gorz in a very good book called L'Immatériel. I claim that there is a demarketization and a demonetization of quite a number of activities, and in particular, those that concern information. So we have a birth of a huge sphere that we all know here, I don't need to describe. But also information technology has much further inflated the financial sphere. And even if when it shrinks very severely, it's still, for example, measured in terms of flow, of flows, instant flows in the world, very big. Now I'm going to forget for a while about finance. I'll come back to that, but it's a welcome rest these days. So I'm going to focus on what is the relationship between market and information non-market. First of all, why is this fear of non-market information production, sharing, exchange, usage? What are its core properties? First thing, I mean, actually it's very beautifully illustrated in the poster for Oeconics, but it is a very rich and interdependent ecosystem. The only thing that is wrong in the poster is that all bubbles have the same size, but it's interdependency, it is of various forms. For example, for software, it's very direct dependency. That is, to run a piece of software, you need other ones, and you at a given time, you might be running 20 different pieces of software to get the functionality you consider as given by one of them. But in other domains like cultural or creative works, it's clear that the interdependency exists. That is, for example, to recognize that something is a cubist painting or a techno dance floor piece of music, you need the fact that it belongs to a much bigger set of works. And a lot of what of the key constraints on creating the condition of existence for producing all these things comes from the fact that it is rich, diverse, and interdependent. Now it's mediated by commons, and there the key thing is to point a risk coming from the fact that because we did not have an explicit statute, positive definition for the commons when we started recreating the modern commons, we emulated it by contractual means, or even if you think that licenses are not contractual or not transactional, I mean, they are just permissions. Nonetheless, they are sort of worded bilaterally with words like you. And this is, in my opinion, misleading on the real nature of what happens in a commons-based word. And commons-based word is what enables peer-to-peer production, or they co-evolve. And in that situation, what we have is we have a contributor that are giving or donating or dedicating to the commons things that they produce, and we have users who are taking things from the commons and use them. And of course, these are not separate categories, but what is important is there is no need for a direct bilateral relationship between the two. And actually, when schemes that belong on the left side of the slide are imported in the situation of the commons, they risk polluting them. And by creating, for example, transaction costs that are the worst enemy in the production of information. And the last key property is, it's a classical description. Actually, putting it on a line is probably a bit misleading, but it's the idea that because there is freedom of usage and concrete means of deriving new usage from existing things, we move from the situation where we had a clear separation between producers and consumers, or in the cultural and creative field, producers or creators and on one side and receptors on the other side. We move to a continuum of positions. And this is the people who stand for the cultural elitism. They will describe the continuum as the disparition of the extremes, which is completely wrong. Of course, in the new situation, we will still listen from beginning to end to a piece of recorded music, quote, passively, quote, because of course listening is never passive. But what is new is people can move step by step across the continuum, and these steps are not painless. They call for learning, they call for daring, but they are much less big than moving from receiving to becoming a professional producer. Now, there is a school of thought, and people in it are sometimes friends and generally people I admire for other parts of the work, of their work, like Larry Lessig or even Yochai Benkler. They defend a sort of optimistic vision, let's say, summarizing it at the limit of a caricature, we could say, just make sure that people, that the non-market sphere can live, and it will sort it out itself. I mean, and in a way, there is, it's not unlikely that there is ground for such an affirmation, because, you know, if something is truly useful, it would be very surprising that some form of economy does not develop to serve it, to provide means to it, or to make additional value of it. So, and this is already evidenced by, for example, the fact that in the share of the GDP of developed countries that goes to providing means for production and exchange of information is twice bigger than the economy of selling goods and services of information. That is, if you look at the telecom, the machines, the software, this is much a bigger share of the economy than if you look at all the selling carriers carrying information, all the information services for pay or whatever. And I mean, I have reference for all these things that I will try if there is one there to include there. But one reason to doubt that the transition will be easy is that this information non-market, that initially when it developed, things were nice. I mean, the classical economy was free riding on its creation, but it was not eaten, it was not cannibalized by it. We have reached a very different stage where there is a war going on, a war for time budgets, for attention, for keeping control on the centralization of what gets attention. And due to that, it becomes critical that in this sphere of the market, we get, we meaning people who care about the development of the common space peer production, we get allies. We get not just people who see this development as a risk. There is a second reason, is when the optimistic school of thought wants to evidence that they are right, what they bring is examples of business models. You know, say, and they're right, you know, it's true that Radiohead can make lots of money by freely offering for download and exchange their music and asking people to pay whatever they want. And actually they get more money per average than they would get if they would set a price. But it's true, and it's true that Jamendo can aggregate attention to voluntarily shared music and get some revenue from advertising, and the musicians who share on Jamendo, they get some reputation and they market this reputation through concerts or teaching. It's true, but there are two problems. One is it doesn't scale at the stage of a global society, and I will have to prove that, but I believe it. And the second one is it makes the development of a commons depend on things that are either against it or are polluting its core properties. So what would be a better coupling than just business models? This is an illustration that I put in a book I published in 2005. Where I was trying to illustrate the difference between two extreme models. One would be a model of things, information gets produced only if some investors find an interest in putting money in the production of a component. And that's on the left side. And the second one is kind of basic income scenario where everybody gets an allocation of resources for one's existence and freely allocates time to the production of some of whatever information artifact one wishes to see existing. And basically, okay, this is only what you call, I'm a mathematician by training, so we call that ends weaving. I won't say believe me, I would say check for yourself. I mean, it can be even mathematically modeled why the second approach is better, can be mathematically modeled by transaction cost analysis. Because what happens is, what happens if this one of the gray circles on needs some other form of information, some other component to exist or to be recognized? Well, normally they will themselves invest, they receive money, they will themselves invest in helping these other things to exist. But there is a huge decision and management transaction cost and time transaction cost to that. So really what happens is, and that's basically the reasoning in Yorai Benkler's Causes Penguin article, it's much more efficient for an ecosystem of information artifacts to be more globally funded. I mean, he did not take this conclusion, but this reasoning, for me, naturally drives us to it. So now I will move to an example. And of course, it's an example that is important for me because I spent about 1 year and a half now deriving elaborated proposals to put it in place. But here I'm using it just as a kind of a lab test for defining some criteria in a more general domain. So basically the creative contribution is the same, is one flavor of things like the culture flat rate in Germany or blanket licensing in the US or collective licensing for peer-to-peer in many countries or extended collective licenses in Italy. And it's all the schemes that say basically we are going to recognize either legally or through some blanket contracts the fact that individuals can share digitally published cultural works, creative works, music, video, whatever, between themselves, provided it's outside market, it's not for profit directly or indirectly. And at the same time, that applies to all individuals, whether in parallel, a flat rate contribution by in most cases it's specified broadband internet subscribers are asked to pay a monthly fee in general collected through the ISPs or for convenience and efficiency reasons, and this will be used in most cases. It was used just to remunerate or reward the creators of works that have been used on the internet. And one of the things I developed in my own proposals was to say, okay, we use only 50% of the product for that. We use the other half for funding the creation of new works. And there are many reasons for doing that. But one of the most pressing ones is not to give all the money to the heirs of deceased right holders, so that are one of the worst rent-seeking lobbies we have on this planet that has many. Now, using this example, what can we say about what would be good devices for funding the creation, the condition of existence of the production of commons? And, you know, things like basic income exists. It just exists very bad. It's subject to condition or instead of being unconditional, terribly low. It's not at the amount of allowing real existence. It's at the element of at the level of making possible for people not to die, but it exists in some form, and it's certainly it will develop and it will be a valuable thing. But I don't believe this will be the only scheme, not more than business models. And so let's say I suggest three core properties, and one has to be a bit subspecified. First one is we want schemes that, since it's a matter of funding the condition of contribution and to the commons, we want it to be respectful of the good properties of the commons. That's quite evident, except that it means we have to, it's going to be much more difficult to realize in practice than the original evidence of wanting it. What I suggest as sub-criteria is that we have the resources within the overall set of people who contribute should be allocated with some role of decentralized choices. I will come back to what why I qualify with some role. Because sometimes, of course, for if you have a basic income situation, it's each individual allocating one's own time. But sometimes it's much different scheme because not everybody is a producer, not every. Then we want a usage-driven assessment of value. That is, we don't, in general, we don't want a pre-definition of what is valuable to support, though in some cases it's obligatory. Because there are things that call for large investment, and so we have to put in place some schemes that we pre-decide that it would be valuable to build the successor to the Large Hadron Collider, or this movie rather than this one. Finally, what we want is to keep the freedom of organization that is enabled by the fact that the rights are commons-based, they are not transactional. That means we can have very hierarchical production structures within the commons. There's nothing wrong with it. I mean, many or most free software projects have hierarchical structures. Actually, 80% of them have an immensely hierarchical structure because they are made of only one individual. But the 20% of others, they are not generally bazaars. The bazaar is in the overall ecosystem, not in individual projects. But why is it not a problem? While it would be a big problem in other processes, is because at any time anybody can come and take it and bring it to in the direction of other aims, other goals, other styles, or whatever. So it means that we are not installing a hierarchical organization for production does not relinquish freedoms of defining goals, or to some extent, because of course, forking or taking some piece of existing thing and making it into something else has a cost. Finally, the two other are slightly more easy to state. We want scalability, and the existing state of the non-market information domain is certainly not what we should target, because if, as I believe, information production and exchange is going to be some form of quaternary sector after agriculture, industry, and services. The limit with services will be very hard to define, but it's if it is the case, regardless of whether it will replace the other sectors or redefine them drastically, like was suggested by Smari this morning, which I have my doubts about on how much it will or how it will do it. Regardless of that, certainly we want it to expand to a huge sphere of activities. So there must be built-in scalability in terms of the global flow of resources that can go into it. Finally, we want, and I think this is not often said, but we want, up to now, information technology has fueled to a great extent schemes that have led to growing social injustice. At the same time, the Information Commons propose a model of social justice, but the question of whether there is a positive retroaction of the existence of Information Commons on the social justice in other domains becomes more and more critical. And I think if we are not able to convince people that in the crisis time, for example, Information Commons are more needed than they were needed before, they will get convinced of the opposite thing. You know, we don't want the, we already had the deflating financial bubble, we don't want that the intellectual property bubble crashes at the same time, is what they will think. Huh? But the intellectual property bubble will crash anyway, so it's better that we find ways to live, to survive this eventuality. So this is about the same thing, except that I tried to define what could be an indicator of how a scheme for funding the contribution to commons has a positive retroaction on the economy or the social justice in the other domains. And I will precise what I mean by without too much deperdition, but basically what I mean is the way resources are allocated should be such as not too much inflates the non-commons compatible aspects of the economy. For example, the financial bubble or the what I called just now the intellectual property bubble. Going back to my example of cultural works, I would like to give you an illustration of how this can be very precisely modeled. Please don't think this is another long tail boring stuff, because first of all, this is not a long tail curve. The long tail curves, they have the popularity or the access or the usage in coordinates, and they have the decreasing ranks of popularity in abscess. Here, these are, and they all look the same. They all look the same. They look like something that goes very near the axis. But they are immensely different. And if you want to see that difference, you have to go to cumulative distributions, because then it becomes evident, and cumulative distribution are the key indicator of inequality. That is, if you compute a Gini indicator, for what is a classical indicator for inequality, you look at how much the cumulative distribution is far from the diagonal right. Here, for these two, the red and the blue curves, they are actual distributions. They are not IDs. They correspond, one corresponds to the distribution of attention, the red one, distribution of attention in a classical publishing industry or distribution controlled industry. And what you can see is basically the 80% of works, they get around 5%, the 80% less popular works, they get around 5% of attention, usage, sales, depending on the situation you're studying. The other one is actually, if you look at open information communities like Dogmazic or Jamendo for sharing music, or if you look at the open internet, you will find a blue curve that is even higher than that. But the internet corresponds to, the blue curves correspond to a parameter of Z-flow of 0.75. The overall distribution of access to sites on the internet, which you can easily compute by using Alexa data, for instance, this is corresponds to 0.7, so it's a bit higher. But I said, okay, if we legalize peer-to-peer, maybe there will be less diversity of attention, because we live in a work that in a world that will still be very driven by classical media promotion. And so here we see that instead of having the 80% less popular works getting 5%, they get more 35% of attention. And why is this immensely important? Is because here, all these things that are not stars, by the way, the stars, they will get 5% of most popular works, they will get 44% instead of more than 95, which is, and this is, this is in actual studies, like the TNO studies on peer-to-peer unauthorized file sharing that was just published a few months ago. And the key issue is all the stuff that follows, that is like the 30% intermediate popularity works, that are things that already quite a few people have found interesting. So they must not be total crap. Or it's, of course, some of them might be, but not statistically. And these things, they will receive more attention. They will be given their chance to get an audience. Now comes the issue of, imagine we put in place this remuneration scheme that I mentioned. That is, we get a way to measure usage of shared works on the internet, and I have made precise proposals on that, and non-intrusive in privacy, and statistically precise. How do we distribute the product of money? It will be distributed much in more equitably because of a good, more diverse cultural diversity, more diversity of attention. But still, I mean, giving more than 44% to a number of works that most probably are heavily promoted, this is going to put lots of money in the pockets of people who all go to Switzerland, or because tax is lower, it's maybe not a good idea. So Richard Stallman, he proposed, who by the way has a variety of proposals on now, one being send $1 to the artist whenever you wish, which I think is importing a transactional scheme too much in the process. But he also supports what he called taxes. I think it's completely wrong. It should be called mutualistic funding schemes of the type I have been advocating. And what he proposes is to use the cubic root, which is quite drastic, because really it's a very flat progression of income compared to popularity. I think this is, I think actually it's even too much in terms of what people, and when I mean people, I mean users, desire. But it's clear that in the physical carrier publishing sphere, we have schemes that are over linear. That is, the more you're popular, the bigger percentage you get. And for music, for book publishing, it goes from 8 to 12%, so it's not very important. But for music, it goes from 95% of people getting no royalty-based income at all to some people getting 15 or 20% and more if they are self-producer. So going under linear is certainly something that has a lot of standing for. And of course it will be, I'm not even expecting that it will be accepted anywhere initially. Initially, I'm sure if we can get the legalization and with a linear scheme of remuneration is already wonderful. And I would like to conclude on that note, let's say that in a world of complexity and coexistence, let's say perfection might be the worst enemy of justice. I mean, it's to want absolutely to have exact recording of everything, of course, it leads to universal surveillance. But also to want to have a perfectly satisfying scheme for the creating the condition of existence of a common, it risks leading us to have no scheme at all. And it's not a kind of, blackmail, not black, I don't know, chantage, it's not... blackmail, but it's not exactly meaning the same thing. It's not just saying you have to accept that it's bad, but it's better than anything else you are going to get. But it's a warning against the search for perfect justice. I'm done. So I guess normally there is someone asking their questions. So, are there questions or comments? Or
what do you think of the Creative Commons?
Well, the Creative, I mean, for example, Jamendo, it's all Creative Commons or Licence Art Libre. To me, the Creative Commons are, the way I think about it is, it's the laboratory of a law of the future. I mean, to me, what I've proposed actually is that NCND, non-commercial, non-derivatives, becomes a minimum recognized right in the digital sphere. While I thought it was really important to leave the choice of giving more rights to a voluntary choice, partly because it's unfair to the communities. I mean, I'm myself a big producer of Creative Commons content, so it's not for me that I'm saying that, but I think it's unfair to the voluntary community to say them, now you're going to do that, but we take off the voluntary aspect from you. I think we are forced to do that because actually I think the right to share cultural works is a positive right for everyone. It was very recently taken off, and it's in the a book you have a right. I mean, you buy it, you have the right to rent it, even not just non-market activities. You have the right to sell it, to rent it, to do whatever you want with it. It's final sales doctrine, and it's challenged by the right holders' lobbies, but it's there. And now we have to go back to the wisdom of saying, okay, it was not a good idea to destroy this right when moving in the digital sphere. It was a better idea to organize how the economy can live with this right. And so that's, now can, there is another side to your question, is could we just count on the Creative Commons for doing it by themselves? And there, I'm skeptical. Why? Because let's go at Jamendo. Okay, a musician that shares music on Jamendo, they get no income from what they care for, that is people listening, and they get only an indirect income from maybe concerts, and in most cases, things that actually are only weakly improved by their reputation, like teaching. I mean, and as a result, I hate to make statements about quality for creative works, but Jamendo has, let's say, higher quality than previous experiments. But still, it's clear that people who produce music and think they have a real potential for getting it appreciated by a crowd, they won't go on it. Because there are lots of locking mechanisms that exist on access to audiences, and they are not solved simply by putting a work on Jamendo. Because when you put a work on Jamendo, in most countries, you say you're not going to get, you're not only not getting income from sharing on the internet, you don't get income from the radio licensing, you don't get income from television licensing, you don't get income from public performance of recorded music, because the collective management societies will not give you that. That can be solved by forcing them to do it, and it's in process in the Netherlands and Italy and France. It's bettering a bit, but still, I believe this is not going to scale up. Except in areas like, I'm convinced every scientific publication will be 10 to 15 years from now open access. But there are other reasons. I mean, we were already paying for everything.
Taking up your example with music and going back to Smari's comment this morning, namely there is enough music around, probably not enough good music. Now this is the problem you are addressing, because on the one hand there is a popular demand for music. For example, if I make a free radio program, I need some music in between, and given the amount of music around, it's quite all right that it should be free. Now, I'm not entitled, and I wonder if your point is that I would be entitled to use the music, the most recent Michael Jackson, Herbert von Karajan.
The idea is definitely yes.
You should. I wonder, because I'll tell you as a counterexample from the software, from where all of this comes. Quite recently, I wanted to have changing images on my blog, and I found out that there is open source, free, accessible software which allows me to change images on the header of my blog, the WordPress blog. But it's a community edition. It is restricted to 5 pictures, and it allows me to change it every hour or every day, but not every 5 minutes. Now, I'm perfectly happy with this guy offering his more advanced 25 pictures change in 55 minutes and then be able to pay for that. And I think this would be quite in line with some of the general principles you have.
But I think actually the key issue is what are the models that are compatible with free sharing non-for-profit between individuals. And I believe these type of models, of which I am a provider, by the way, are not going to suffer. I do not believe, I am 100% sure that the income of creators of artists will not suffer. 80% of it has never come from the private consumption of works. Even I speak of 80% of author rights, of copyright, not 80% of all income, because lots of that comes from other activities. But even the business models, they are the only models that are, I mean, that's also what the studies repeatedly prove, and simply nobody, I mean, we are in the process of stopping people from seeing that one shared work is one lost sale or even 0.1 lost sale. It's not the case. Simply, the idea that you cannot sell something because it's available for free is deeply wrong. Radio has given us the possibility to listen for free to music for ages, and not only was it not harmful to the sales of records, but it was a condition for the sales of records. That's where you listen with serendipity to something that you did not choose, and you said, oh, what is this thing? I want to buy it. So, I mean, it's not that I have anything against the restriction in the contract of that person. Just think, is the added value, you know, the same service, saying I'm going to give you quality assessed according to my standard of quality, or thematic images, or things, the location, finding the location of quality in a world of abundance of creation is an immensely difficult task. I mean, which is not going to be solved at all by the type of schemes I'm advocating. It's just going to be unable to start looking for ways of doing it, which are experimented in the free sharing or open information communities, but are still very primitive. I mean, look at Jamendo, you know, it's the top 100, but is its self-amplification of random tastes. Or look at Dom Mazic, it's basically that plus randomly picked works to try to compensate for the first and most recent to give a chance to everybody. But this is very primitive, and recommendation systems, they would be good if people use them, but contributed actively to them, but they don't, and they certainly are not going to do it if the recommendation system only fuels the interest of an intermediary like Amazon. If you look at Amazon, it's very efficient because it studies people like who like this book also bought this one. That is, they exploit information that they can automatically grab and that you don't have. But all the recommendation systems simply doesn't work on Amazon. You know, the reading list and things like that. So why doesn't it work? Because there is no trust with a provider. If we are in a world of authorized sharing, we start getting trust. I mean, there are many competing providers. We can find one we trust more to help. And we can start looking. It's going to be a real challenge. Yeah?
When you're speaking about the information commons, if you see music, that's a product that is digitizable. Uh-huh. After the advent of digital recording devices that was known by record labels, I can record music in my bedroom, literally, and put it and distribute it on the same computer that I recorded it. But some information commons sort of preconceived that there's some sort of production or label. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, like blueprints to bridges or aeroplanes or whatever. So what is the
border?
What's the definition of these information commons? Is it both sort of topologies?
It's first of all the delineation. For me, I tried to make it not, it would have been easy to do it domain-wise, but I thought it was mistaken because, so I tried to find deeper rooted criteria, and the first criteria I found is something that has been, you can only share freely things that have been offered to the general public for a pay off or not, that doesn't matter, in digital form. So for example, you cannot shoot a movie in a movie theater and put it on the internet, or scan a book and put it on the internet. You are still a counterfeiter, an infringer to intellectual property, right? In France, we call that counterfeiter, but it's stupid. And things that people want to keep secret, certainly, and there are things I don't share as a free software company. I might even share models, you know, UML models or MDA models of what we are doing, but certainly I'm not going to share the know-how on how we drive the development of our products or things like that. And if even if that is encoded in on information, I would consider, I want a law to protect me against intruding and selling or distributing that information. I don't know if that answers really your question, but there is another side to it, is music basically calls for a very moderate investment in production, except some exceptions. For music, the main need in production is people who do artistic direction, they bring together artists with a common vision of where to drive some obscure school of music, and they try to help artists to be better, whatever what that means. And that we need to fund intermediaries in music, but we don't need to fund production. In movies, maybe one day it will be like music, because there are trends of also producing music in bedrooms, like in Nigeria. And it's interesting, not the porn part of it, but the for example, all the traditional tales movies and things like that. It started by porn, by the way. So historically, that was the enabler, but it was it developed to other things. But we are not there. That is, I still want to see feature films. I want them. I like it. And actually, I'm not the only one, because in Europe, the theater frequentation for movies has never been as big in the 15 last years. So much for sharing, stealing all the money from the producers. There, it becomes difficult, because this is like the Large Hadron Collider. You have to decide up front. Of course, you can organize community schemes of production, but I also think they work for the first two people who do it. But they won't scale for several hundreds of movies being produced in a country or Europe. So for that, what do we have at hand on deciding what movies? We have peer-based evaluation, generally state organized, and easily, appropriated by the interest of people who initially were probably well motivated, but grabbed it for their own tastes and interests. And so there, some people have proposed schemes that are, I believe, compatible with some of the values of SMARI, but more elaborated, that is like competitive intermediaries. That is what I've proposed, for example, is for the production side of the use of a product of the fee, people I'm sorry to give that example, like for religious tax in some countries, you tick which religion you wanted to go. And if you are a very daring German, you say you don't have one. You don't pay. But it's there you have intermediaries who compete on policies they post. Say, yeah, we are going to support advanced hip hop music and whatever, and you allocate individuals, users this time, they allocate money to intermediaries. I don't believe in this scheme for artists, for direct support to artists or works, because it's too much transaction cost intensive. But to do that once in a year, you know, for support to inter, and it has been proposed, for example, for health innovation. And the origin of this scheme is health innovation. For people where things like neglected diseases, for example, could be funded, research on neglected diseases could be funded in that way. Yes. I don't know if we are on time. No more?
So yes. this last point would also provide some security, if there were some more, some new intermediaries, some security to artists who invest in their music, and then in the end they get the usage-based compensation, so they would have a kind of barrier of security there.
Yes, they would have, I mean, it enables the longer lasting existence of structures, let's say. It's not because going, you know, the property of the information market is like an instantaneous perfect market. But the philosophers I'm referring to Herbert's talk this morning, you know, there is still a philosopher's side, and I mean, someone who needs to work in a long lasting manner to develop the ability to participate, to be an active participant in the instantaneous information exchange, you need to develop capabilities that are long to build, that are lots of work, that are much more intensive in their condition of existence, and the premise to secure that. And I didn't mention tax, that I'm in strong contrast to Smari. I think tax have a future, and I mean, I stand for tax. I stand for equitable tax. We are immensely far from it, but and because some of the conditions, like the even in with peer-to-peer education, we still need an education system. We don't. It's not true that it is going to happen just in a totally distributed manner. And let's wait till it happens like that before we stop the education system.
One more point, Herbert, if I may. You've been a bit unfair to Yochai Benkel, I think. You just indicated that he thought that all of this would work out itself. But I do think there is an interesting feature in his theory, namely he points out that there have to be certain conditions and set certain input, certain content can be better used for peer production than other. He's talking about the granularity of the stuff, and it's easy to see why he's saying so. The Wikipedia is a success, but Wikibooks is by far not as successful at all. Now, if one goes into this, my feeling is that your mathematician's attempt to just play with graphs would be to have scrutinized, and there would be a plurality of graphs and a plurality
of
content.
Yeah,
they
are meaningful. I mean, I do it on the overall internet for fun, simply because it's actually easy, which is incredible. But it's easy because someone has done the work for you. before. And it's lots of work. And it's actually biased work, but you don't care. But I think you are referring to, first of all, the last thing I would like to do is to be unfair to your height, because I'm immensely grateful and dependent on his work for my own work. So, but I think there are two different issues. One is recognizing where information commons schemes work, and there he is very discriminating, and he has a marvelous analysis of how what schemes made it possible also to work in each domain, in addition to the intrinsic properties of the domain. But the other thing is on the coexistence with the economics. I mean, we had discussion on that, and I don't think I'm unfair when I say that there is an slightly unsubstantiated optimism in his approach on that. And I mean, I wrote the introduction to the French translation of The Wealth of Networks, and I ended up with a comparison with The Wealth of Nations which was not the original title, but it's the title we know for Adam Smith's work. And I said, okay, I think Yochai's work will be as important. And just as Adam Smith, it will be important not for its direct findings, but for inspiration in other domains. Because the main Adam Smith book is, I mean, you reread it, which not many people are doing. It's actually horrendous, this stuff. I mean, it's full of, it has a totally wrong vision of, in compared to fact of division of labor. It is what it says on education would be a real help. But it inspired the modern organization of a manufacturer from which the modern organization of computing comes through Babbage. It inspired evolutionary theory. And I see Yochai as a foundation, in particular the Causes Penguin article, or also Towards a Common Infrastructure, another article, more than the Wealth of Networks, as this kind of foundation. Everything is there. I mean, everything Lessig or many other people write comes from there. So I don't want to be unfair to him.